everybody. Thank you for coming to the Oxford Martin School for the third panel discussion in our series on Can Emerging Technologies Save the World? And I think we're going to find some very interesting and rather frightening facts out today as we talk about our cyber future, the opportunities and risks when virtual meets reality. And we have three wonderful experts here today to talk about that. We have Professor Sadie Kreese, who's the Professor of Cybersecurity, a relatively new post here at the University of Oxford, based in the Department of Computer Science. But Professor Kreese works in a very interdisciplinary way, and that's why we love her here at the Oxford Martin School. She looks at the technology and the risks, but also the human interactions and those human and ethical components. We also have here Martin Sadler, who's the director of the Cloud and Security Lab in HP Labs. And he's the one who was frightening me just a few minutes before we started this seminar with some scary things about computer chips in cars that could bring down the whole of the Olympics. But he said we're not going to go there today. But he'll give some interesting comments. And Greg Williams is here from Wired magazine to facilitate a discussion afterwards. And he has a long list of very provocative questions that I hope we'll be able to get through at least in the beginning before we open it up to all of you and invite you to be a part of this conversation on how do we secure our cyber future. Thank you very much. I think we're starting with Martin.
So what we thought we'd do is we'd start by talking a little bit about where we see the world actually going in the next few years. here's some facts. These are some numbers about that are kind of these are public numbers. I think these are IDC's versions, but if you look across the industry, these are pretty common kind of numbers about the world we're going to be living in. So just to give you a sense, we're going to be talking about the middle classes having expanded globally, and we're talking about something like 4 billion people online. So every time we talk about educating the public about issues like cybersecurity and what it means to be safe online and what it doesn't mean to be safe online, how many of those 4 billion people around the globe can have any idea what safe online actually means? Maybe 400 million in the Western world. So the vast majority of people online are going to have no idea about what it means to protect themselves. If we look at the amount of code being written, we're talking about something of the order of about 25 million apps in a smartphone environment. So everyone out there that says, oh, it will only be okay if everyone wrote their software well, that's not going to work for 25 million apps. The vast majority of software that we're all going to be using is going to be inherently unreliable, riddled with malware, and very, very easy for anyone who wants to break in and do nasty things to us to get hold of it. So the sheer numbers are just taking us to a very uncomfortable place in terms of the way we think about things. Roughly 30 billion connected devices. So these are devices like your smartphones and your notebook computers and your home desktop computers and the computers that are in your car that will manage, you know, your GPS and everything in your car. The interesting one is roughly 1 trillion sensors. So here's one, I bought one. This is very simple. This is just an accelerometer. The tiny chip in the middle is an accelerometer. These are what's in your cars to trigger the airbags. It's what's in your computer for when you drop it to freeze the disc from spinning, if it's got a spinning disc in it, and so that doesn't break. What are they used for? In oil and gas, they're being used for oil exploration now. You can put thousands upon thousands of these down in an area, you shock the earth, and you can do the signal processing and work out whether there's oil underneath. You can take one of these, and you can put it on a hospital bed. If you put it on a hospital bed, you can do the signal processing to determine whether or not someone's heartbeat is acting inappropriately. So you take someone out of intensive care, you don't need to have all the leads put on them that we do today. Just one of these on the hospital bed and signal processing is enough to be able to work out what state they're in. Not only can you do the heart with this, in terms of the tiny, tiny tremors that your heartbeat causes on the hospital bed, it's picking up your breathing, it's picking up every time you move. It can tell whether you've moved enough, so whether or not you're going to develop bed sores because you're not moving enough, for example, in the bed. Now, what I want you to imagine is, if we can do all that today, what are these things going to be doing in our environment in 10 years' time, or by 2020, when we're talking about roughly a trillion of them in the actual environment? 1,000 billion, 1,000,000,000,000 of these. And you can bank on the majority of those are going to be in the Western world. Okay? So we are going to be early adopters in Northwest Europe, like North America, in how these sensors are going to be instrumenting our environment. Some of it's going to be good, it'll be doing traffic management on the roads. But if you worry about privacy, if you worry about surveillance society, this is going to take us into a surveillance society big time. And then if you start questioning, well, if it's so easy for people to get into our phones, and it's so easy, you know, for people not to be safe online, what happens to all the people who can access this information in the environment around us? And it isn't just going to be sensors. There are going to be the actuators, the things that actually, they're not just passive recording information, they're going to do things. By 2020, today you can't count the number of chips in your home and your cars. There's about 70 separate computers in a high-end car. Okay, you probably can't count the number of microprocessors in your home. By 2020, we'll start in the Western world not to be able to count the number you have in your body. You're going to start to inject tiny, tiny, very, very small things that will start for people like diabetics to monitor insulin levels, these kind of things. By 2020, we'll be reaching that point where we're putting so many of these in to monitor different things in our bodies. Now, imagine, great opportunity for people who are diabetic. If it's controlling the amount of insulin being released into your bloodstream, perfect. You can live a really great existence. What happens if someone else has access to that device and can trigger the wrong level of insulin going into your bloodstream? And of course, we're going to have vast, vast amounts of information. So that's kind of like the scene setting. We want to give you a sense that whatever the problems with cybersecurity today, and we're going to talk about those, and there's an awful lot of them, it's going to get a whole lot worse. And we can give you horror stories all afternoon if you really want more examples, okay? So I'll talk through one example of what happens with today's cyber attack, and then Sadie will talk a little bit about what's going on underneath all that. So this is a typical, this is the nature of a typical sophisticated attack. This is the kind of attack at a fairly high level of abstraction that is going on government systems all day, every day, from nation state adversaries. This is the kind of attack that goes on large corporates all day, every day. This is the kind of attack, if you heard about Stuxnet, the attack on the Iran nuclear facility, this is the kind of attack that was perpetrated against Iran. And the way it works is, so imagine I want to attack you. Imagine if I want to attack you, what I would do is I'd go out and find out what social networking sites you're on. I'd find out a little bit about. You all give away far too much information about yourselves online, and that's a good thing, apparently, but we all do it. And so I'd go to LinkedIn, I'd go to Facebook, I'd find out something about you, and that would enable me to craft a nice message to you, a spear phishing attack. Phishing is about conning people into doing the wrong things in terms of their machine. Spear phishing is a very directed con, directed at you individually. Very easy to do. I can make the email look like it's come from one of your friends. I can make it look like this photo is attached to an event you were at, so you're just going to open that photo up. And unfortunately, when you open that photo up in the email, that's it. All bets are off at that point, because you've just allowed me to insert a piece of code into your smartphone or into your computer. And that's exactly what goes on with government infiltration. That's exactly what went on with Stuxnet. When you're in, you establish a foothold. What does this piece of code do? It's no longer a single piece of code. Some of the most sophisticated code that's being written on the planet is being written by cyber attackers today. If you look at it, it's incredibly clever in terms of what they do. It's not a single piece of code, it's lots of separate pieces of code doing things together. It establishes a foothold in your machine, it will collect information about your machine, and it will spread quietly. Now that may not matter in your home, it's just spreading to all the devices in your home. So it doesn't just, you know, take everything off the current phone or computer you've got, it might spread to your friends, everyone else. May not matter in the citizen case, because they're probably not going to steal a great deal from you. You might get hold of your bank account, you might have to change your bank account. Okay? In terms of a corporation, if this is the Department for Work and Pensions in the UK, and you get in and you can tap in and you can corrupt the entire social, you know, the pension payments for everyone in this country, the amount of devastation you can cause is huge. Huge. So you spread, usually quietly, and at some point you deliver a payload. And of course you iterate around this. many, many times. That's sort of a high-level abstraction of what is going on. That's exactly what happened with Stuxnet. That's exactly, as I say, the nature of today's attacks. But imagine this in this world that we're talking about. So, this is going to happen more and more at scale. This is happening in a very sophisticated way. It's going to happen at scale. It's becoming industrialized. There are lots and lots of attackers with lots and lots of goals. There's a lot of con artistry going on. The people doing this are very, very clever indeed, and we really need to get our act together in how we defend. At which point, I'm glad Sadie talk about all the good things we need to do.
Thank you, Martin. So, but before I do, I'm going to lift the lid slightly on the threat, and in particular, given the big numbers and the scale issue that we know that we're facing, how do we expect the threat to evolve as we move into the future? Well, what we do typically within the professional space is we think about reward for investment, because everybody is doing this for a purpose. And so the first thing to observe is the more dependent we become upon these systems, the higher the reward, generally speaking, for a threat. The more we need it, the more we're willing to pay to get it back, or the more we're willing to pay to try and recover from the situation. If somebody's trying to do us damage as a nation state, the more we depend upon it, the more horrific it could be if it were removed from us. So, as Martin was alluding to earlier, if these devices pervade our environments, if they're in control of our cars, in control of our whole transport systems, in control of our energy and our utilities, if our getting the food into the supermarkets depend on just-in-time logistics, if the whole of our communications depends on this, then it doesn't take much to wreak complete havoc on society and create horror. If you can no longer go to a hospital because you can't rely on your medical records being accurate, so you don't want any treatments anymore. If you can't get money out of the bank. If you can't get on a mode of transport and rely on it getting there, or at least getting to the place you thought it was going to get to, let alone something awful happening. So the more we depend upon it, the more likely we are to be targeted. Whether we are an individual, whether we're an enterprise, whether we're a nation, it's a problem for society as a whole. But we can take that reward analysis even further, and we can say, well, let's look very specifically at some of the business models that we're faced with today. So, take for example smartphones. Well, almost every prediction out in the marketplace at the moment will say that these phones are going to become the computer device of preference for most of the Western world. This is what people are going to prefer to use. Some form of tablet or phone, but small, portable, an extension of themselves. And they'll feel that way about it. They don't feel that way about desktops or laptops at work. So we increase the footfall. We increase the footfall to the app stores. We increase the footfall to the online services, the social networking. And it's the same with cloud. I'm sure many of you have heard the hype about the move to cloud. No longer having to buy all of your infrastructure and keeping it locally, using it online. Some of you will be using Google Docs, and many of the social networking environments are actually happening in the cloud. Your data is being stored elsewhere on the internet. We increase the footfall. If you increase the footfall to these places, then an attacker gets much more benefit for one hack. And in fact, we now talk about hacking cloud as hyperjacking. So whereas, if you think about this, whereas previously somebody, and consider Stuxnet, highly targeted attack, highly targeted, did the spear phishing to get in actual fact had to get extreme details about the devices that they were actually compromising to change the behavior of these processes within the plant, highly targeted. But if you can replicate that, if you move into a cloud environment or an app store environment, you put one piece of malicious app out there, 1,400,000,000, 4 billion people download it. How much value do you get for that? So the numbers that Martin was showing you, unfortunately, are drivers for threat. They just make the whole place more attractive. And finally, we should note that this does not just simply exist in cyberspace. This is about physical harm, potentially, from cyber activity. Stuxnet was a wake-up call to the general world, and we'd all been expecting it for some time, but it made the press, and suddenly people realised, ooh, cyber stuff can result in things going boom, possibly. Same with the cars and the airplanes, etc. Physical harm. And what we need to understand is that our threats are not just opportunistic anymore. These are not just teenagers hacking from their bedrooms, wanting to show off that they can get somewhere that they shouldn't. Because it's monetized, because there's extreme value that can be gained from this, this is now organized and strategic. People are training themselves to do these things. In fact, there's whole supply chains set up to support attack activity. We often talk in the community about zero-day attacks, and for those of you that don't know what a zero-day is a never-seen-before exploit of a weakness in some system. So it's zero-day, it's the first time we've seen it. And most of you will be familiar with firewalls and virus protection. Well, the vast majority of these technologies that are in use typically depend on someone having seen it before. So they can design what we refer to as a signature, but they can understand what the weakness is and they can distribute a patch against the weakness. And your ability to protect yourself against these things depends upon the speed within which you can install and get yourself patched, so to speak. Well, that doesn't work for zero day. Well, there are organizations now who specialize in finding zero days. Now, they could sell that to people working in the security professional community so that we understand how to protect systems, or they could sell that to bad people who would very much like to exploit a zero day in order to construct an effective attack. So we need to understand that this is already monetized, this is already operational, if you like, and that combined with the increasing rewards will just make this a more attractive place in which to do business. And we also need to understand that this is coming from inside as well as outside our organisations and our nation states. This is security for many years, perfectly naturally, part of humanity, has been seen to be building up walls. This is what we did. We built walls around castles, and then if you remember your history, we brought walls within walls within walls, and there were layers of protection, and you had to get through that wall, through that gate, and you got to the next one, and we protected the inner citadel, the core. And then similarly, we're an island here, so we have port control, and we monitor the seas around us, and then we have airport control, and we start having aircraft landing. And it's perfectly natural, therefore, to build firewalls to protect your perimeter in cyberspace. But unfortunately for us, this stuff comes from the inside. It finds ways of getting into the inside. The spear phishing, the con attack, is a way of getting a footprint on the inside, persuading someone on the inside to do something unsafe, to give you that access. So what are the challenges then? Well, obviously, new technology grows attack surfaces. Unfortunately, we are not in the business, and we never have been in the business, of having crystal balls, understanding every way a piece of technology might be used. The complexity of software nowadays, and the complexity of the systems that consist of many different components of software, are such that we cannot guarantee that we will not have vulnerabilities that are exploitable by bad people. And as our appetite for consuming new technology just seems to grow and grow and grow, we necessarily potentially grow our attack surface. And in all likelihood, it's not potential, we just do. And we have an increasing dependency, and so we have an increasing interdependency on each other, on our organisations, between nations' infrastructures, as humanity on the globe. Many of the initiatives going on in the developing world will rely in some way on technology, whether it's just for their communications, whether it's for their logistics, whether it's for monitoring people's health, leading healthcare, new medicines. They're all relying on technology. And unfortunately, necessarily, our controls are always behind the curve, so there's a constant competition. And they're brittle. And what do I mean by brittle? Most security controls are designed to do a specific job, and as soon as we are faced with new types of attack, they're no good to us. Hence why we can't deal with zero day in most standard virus protection. So you'll hear a lot in the press about good hygiene being necessary. Good hygiene in this sense being keep a watchful eye out. If you know you're using a piece of software, watch out for announcements of vulnerability, install the patches. Some people will even have you download virus protection for your smartphones and make sure you maintain it, and that's good hygiene. And yes, that, that might stop an awful lot of known stuff, but it's no panacea, it won't get us everything. And unfortunately, the reality is that today we lack the metrics to measure how well we're doing at protecting ourselves. There are no globally agreed, repeatable, empirically observable, what you would call scientific rigor behind them, metrics measuring your security posture. How exposed are you? And it's highly context dependent. How exposed are you to these kinds of threats or those kinds of threats? And because your systems are constantly evolving, even as the man on the street, every time you download an app, you change your system. You potentially introduce something new into that system. It's very hard. And unfortunately, it's not all about technology, it's about people. Think back, I mean, certainly I'm old enough, but I remember when I first encountered the internet, there was a huge public awareness campaign going on, and it was about don't open an executable, don't download a .exe file. And a few years later, it was don't click on the picture, because inside the picture is the .exe file. What does that mean, that advice mean, in the smartphone app store business model? Because apps are executable. So what does it mean to educate people in that way? So not only do we have the scale that Martin was talking about, the sheer volume of people that need to be educated, and that's people, think of enterprise, everything we're depending on, but we have a paradigm problem. We don't actually understand what the answer is yet. We don't have the full solution. It's hard to do if you knew it, but we don't have it. We don't know where the boundaries are anymore. We're constantly wanting to adopt new things, moving data around, plugging USBs in, using your personal computers to connect to your work systems, letting your friends connect into your home systems. And we no longer can rely on download the EXE. And so finally, the final observation we wanted to make today was that we can no longer speak in silos. Gone are the days when one could talk about cyberspace and digital stuff over here and the physical world over there, and that we somehow could study them both in isolation and we would end up with a safe and secure environment. In actual fact, our lives are entirely entangled now. It makes no sense to treat these separately. In fact, everything we do from this day forward has to be to understand how they interplay. From a social sense, from a human sense, how do people emotionally engage with these things? How do they emotionally understand security? How do we make protection effective, easy to adopt in a very dynamic and rapidly changing environment?
Thank you, guys. Great presentations from both of you. I think maybe, Martin, this question's kind of maybe for you. There's three kind of major kind of threats that we seem to be kind of facing. One is obviously criminal gangs, the other is hacktivists, the other is kind of very targeted attacks that you were talking about, Sadie. Maybe it's worth kind of getting into what the kind of preferred methods of these criminal gangs are, like backdoors, keylogging, just the very prosaic description for people the way they're going to encounter this kind of malware entering their lives through the internet effectively.
So I think what we have in play really is that new techniques tend to be developed at the nation state level. So that's the big government versus government level. But you see those techniques migrating down into organized crime, and then eventually migrating all the way down into the average 15-year-old who can download them on the internet pretty easily. So there's a constant flow of technology. And so I don't think you can say this technique is being used by this group today, because you're almost out of date the moment you say for a particular technique.
But isn't the case that criminal gangs are creating pieces of malware which then can people can download and they can use them in certain ways, very sort of specific?
What is happening in Trojan, for instance? What's happening with organised crimes, as Sadie said, what we really have is we have an ecosystem. So there isn't one person who goes and does everything. So in fact, a particular hack, you might get someone who's a good con artist who might craft the kind of the spear phishing piece of the attack. Someone else might do the information gathering in terms of working out who to actually attack inside an organisation. Someone else will develop the zero day. Someone else will actually operate that zero day and maintain it. And it may be maintained as a service. So there's a lot of attacks that get into your system and then just go to sleep. And they're waiting for their kind of wake-up call. Mm. And you may do that at organized crime, just get something in there, and then go out and see how you can monetize that. Who's prepared to pay you to wake this particular piece of software up and do something for you?
Sadie, I recently sat with a guy at a security company in Finland who was tracing a particular executable. He was tracing the servers that it passed through. Mm. And we went from Finland to India to the US to Ukraine to Holland, which was where he thinks it was where it's being hosted. Given that cybercrime now crosses multiple jurisdictions, how are we meant to sort of establish protocols? Because if I'm a policeman in the Ukraine, and someone in Italy comes to me and say, hey, look, this piece of malware has come from you. No one in my jurisdiction has been affected. Why should I be worried about it?
It's very challenging. And in fact, for many years, we had arrangements with countries that we had particularly good relations with. But even in those environments, if you spoke to somebody that was charged with responding to a request to gather forensic evidence, digital forensic evidence, you were still faced with that being raised to the top of the pile of actions on their desk. Mm. And often, their local concerns would take priority over some person on the other side of the Atlantic, say. Although we need to take some heart. I mean, it won't be lost on you that we had a conference in London last autumn.
Yes.
That we hosted here in the UK, but it was a global conference. And one of the items on that agenda was how we get better joined up pan-jurisdictional responses to these things. And certainly if you talk to many people around the world charged with crime fighting, they will tell you that the SOCA, our Serious Organised Crime Agency, at least till next year, have been extremely effective helping them and distributing intelligence so that people fighting crime in other countries can and go gather. But it's extremely challenging, and unfortunately the internet's brilliant means for upholding democracy and enabling people to share information, but equally it provides places for people to hide, and it's very difficult responding in that situation. And if you look back at Martin's scale, those figures, it's just going to make it all even more difficult. I mean, if you could sit there and watch an executable move across 10 different servers, what happens when they're moving across peer-to-peer networks across billions of devices? Mm. You don't see them on these ISP gateways. That's not how they're spread.
Do you think, I mean, obviously the web's been a great source of innovation and openness. Do you see a time when maybe there will have to be sort of more regulation where the web won't be as open and free as it is at the moment, simply because of the volume of malicious of malware that's out there?
Well, for some people on the planet, it isn't the free space, is it? It's already being controlled for some people on the planet. I think we already face that. And time and again, there's been initiatives, haven't there, in industry. Many years ago, I remember the internet service providers marketing services to parents to, you know, we can control the internet experience your children have. In fact, parental control is already, present, and people don't see it like that. Mm-hmm. But that control mechanism as a means to providing safety for certain sectors of the population is already in use. Mm-hmm. It would scare me very much if I were living in a country that did it on a society-wide scale.
Yeah. Martin, you talked about the quantity of malicious code being written and that there are now going to be 4 billion people online in the near future, many of whom are just coming online, so they haven't been trained. Do you think, is it possible that the amount of malicious code out there will ever get to the point where the volume of it is so enormous we just can't deal with it? I mean, how do we kind of stay on top of it?
If you look at what goes on inside the security companies, inside the IT companies, it's a search for automation in terms of the defences. Mm-hmm. What you need to do is to get away from people-based defence into much more the machines themselves monitoring what's going on. They're making decisions in sub-second times before humans even get in the loop.
That's the case now, though, in most of the security companies, though, isn't it?
That's the case for certain classes of attack, yes. But, I mean, I think how you cope with the increased volume is you increase your rate of automation in the way that you defend. Mm. So at the moment, what will happen is, inside large organisations, they'll have huge numbers of, they have a thing called a security operations centre, where they're basically monitoring everything that's going on. And there are a vast number of events that they're looking at. Mm. which may or may not constitute a tax on the infrastructure. But there's still people in the loop as analysts looking at what is happening and making decisions. Increasingly, they'll make higher and higher level decisions, and everything will happen without humans being in the loop. Now, that itself has risks.
Yes.
But as I'm sure people will start to think through.
Where do you both stand on, some in the security community have talked about we should all have IDs for use when we're online. Where do you stand on that? Should we be issued with online
IDs? We do, but most people have about 10, don't
yes.
they? I mean...
I'm talking about official state IDs that
right.
will be issued
well,
and
I think
would verify our identity.
Well, I think it depends whose internet you think it is. If you think it's the planet's internet, mm-hmm. which is sort of what it is at the moment,
mm-hmm. yeah.
then a state-issued ID may or may not be terribly useful to you.
Yeah.
It might be useful for you in the way you engage with your national government. It probably isn't going to be much use to you in how you engage with corporations and the way you buy goods and services mm-hmm. around the planet. Mm-hmm. After all, you still want the freedom to go and buy from some tiny company in some other country if you choose to trust them, and
sure.
without necessarily having to use a particular identity that's come from a particular government.
Mm-hmm. Should we get into maybe some of the kind of state sort of cyber attacks that have happened in the last few years? Many of them are sort of DDoS attacks, and I know some are very kind of targeted, and clearly no one knows who created Stuxnet, but certainly people in the security industry have their suspicions. Could you maybe describe, say, how a sort of like a nation state attack might happen? How does something like Stuxnet actually happen? How do they write a piece of code that is very specifically aimed at?
A lot of so DDoS is distributed denial of service. It's basically stopping things working. A lot of that isn't coming from government. I mean, that is coming from organised crime.
Sure.
And it's a way to extort money out of organisations.
Well, there was an attack in Estonia, which was
Estonia
attack,
was a state.
DDoS.
Well, it was activists acting on behalf of
yes.
a particular state, but Sorry, go on.
Richard Clark, I'm sure you've read the book. He has this very kind of purple passage in the book where he talks about an attack on DC and the security infrastructure goes down, and the banks go down, and no one can buy Starbucks, horror of horrors. And I've talked to other various people in, sort of in the security community, and they say, yeah, this is possible, but it's so unlikely.
It's possible, but it is unlikely. I mean, it's not in any nation state's interest to destroy the planet.
Yeah.
And, right. and no, but seriously, if you think of a country like China, you know, all the thing in the press about China, why would China want to destroy their largest markets? Well, that makes no sense. They're not going to destroy the markets.
But it might want to hack into a Google server to get
If you talk about industrial espionage, you talk about all those other things, maybe.
Mm.
But the idea that they're going to completely destroy the planet, I think, is slightly far-fetched for any major country around the globe. I think the fear is with nation states for which it's rather like the nuclear fear. It's the same arguments for you know, North Korea or Iran with the nuclear industry, and do they have a nuclear capability? It's what happens if there is a nation state for which you really don't feel that they're bought in to the whole globe staying up and running? And what if they develop the capability to do these things?
Yeah. And I guess what's particularly concerning is that it's exceptionally asymmetric.
Mm-hmm.
The cost of entry to launching a cyber attack is much lower than the cost of entry to developing a nuclear weapon.
Sure.
So in terms of who can enter that market
mm-hmm.
and weaponize,
mm-hmm.
there's a much bigger pool of people.
But you shouldn't be. But just to be clear, you shouldn't be afraid, because right now the number of nation states that really have that kind of capability is very, very small.
Yeah.
How many? Six, seven.
Yeah.
Sorry, Alison.
No, that's okay.
To
I was going to interrupt because I think this is a fascinating conversation, but I would love to give our audience a chance to interrogate all of you, and I don't want Greg to get off too lightly here. As a communicator of science and technology from a very well-known magazine called Wired, is there a role for journalists and communicators of science in helping to address the challenges of our cybersecurity? And if so, what might that be?
Yeah, I think that there's enormous opportunity for us, but I think that, you know, what we try and do at Wired is try and ignore some of the kind of the more, you know, apocalyptic sort of Hollywood versions of what might happen. You know, just, and I'm not in any way kind of, you know, as deep, don't have the deep expertise of my two esteemed panellists, but just from the people I talk to, there does seem to be some kind of gap, I think, between the capability of, say, let's take for an example of the PLA, what they might be able to achieve, and what they actually do want to achieve, which is very different. So, as you say, they don't necessarily want to go to sort of cyber war with the United States, but they might want to find out a little bit of what's going on in a few defence contractors and not leave any tracks, so no one actually knows that it's them doing it. And I don't want to just take the PLA, a lot of other people. So I guess I didn't really answer your question, did I? I think that, yes, there is a role for us, but I think we need to...
The hype, I
don't want to say we want to downplay the hype, because I think it is real. There's no two ways about that, and there are very serious kind of criminal gangs active throughout, particularly in Eastern Europe. But I also think that we need to be kind of be careful, and we also need to talk... we were talking earlier about... I talked to sort of, you know, some academics in Southern California who are sort of very doubtful of the numbers. The UK government saying that there's 27 billion, and I know you don't necessarily agree with this number. Say this 27 billion is the cost of cybercrime in the UK now. How do they come up with that number? Where's that from? Like, I spoke to someone at the Home Office who didn't want to go on the record as to how the number had been extrapolated. Why are you giving it out then? It just seems pointless.
I won't answer that one, but the previous comment you made, I think where you're all important is what we can't have happen is we don't talk about it, or it's all Hollywood, and then all of a sudden something big does happen, which it could, like Stuxnet, but it could affect all of us. And what we have then is politicians doing the knee-jerk reaction, something draconian coming in, and society hasn't really had an opportunity to think through what is the right course of action for where we want to go as a society. And that's where everybody has a role to play. Because the more educated you are about these issues, the more you're aware of them, the more we could create dialogue around them, the better chance we have to understand where we want to go. Issues like privacy, issues like copyright, issues like cyberbullying are all very difficult issues for us to understand what is the actual right way forward for society. And we know there are different cultural differences between North America and Europe in how we should treat some of these problems. But if we don't talk about them, we're not going to find the solutions. So it's very, and this is, I know what your school does, so it's like, but it's, yeah. but I think that's why it's very important to engage people in the debate. And
yes. And
before we get something dramatic happen, and then it's all bets are off.
Yeah. And what concerns me is that cyberspace is a very intangible, in some ways, thing in terms of risk, and yet highly tangible in terms of everybody has an experience of it.
Yeah.
And in fact, they don't see it as separate. It's just part of life.
Mm.
And yet, we're not doing a very... Nobody understands what the equivalent of locking their car door or their front door is in cyberspace, or looking left and right before you cross the road. And there's some very kind of real basic...
Well, you don't understand. When you walk down the street in Oxford, I'm sure you understand. If you were walking down the streets at 1 a.m. in the morning, you'd know where you'd feel safe and where you probably wouldn't feel safe in different districts around... I'm sure there are districts where you don't feel safe around Oxford. But you don't have any of that on cyberspace.
Yeah.
And in cyberspace, probably if you go to the BBC website, you feel relatively safe. If you go to John Lewis's or Amazon, you probably feel relatively safe. But then it all gets a bit murky. You're not really sure when you go to a website, is this reputable or isn't it? Or have they done a good... And you may feel really safe because you kept going to them for month after month, but you have no idea whether they're actually safeguarding your credit card information or not when you put it in there.
And the kinds of social engineering that these criminal gangs are engaged in, is they understand the emotional response. They're playing on what it means to feel safe, whether you're the target of a spear phishing attack, so they were just after you, Greg, or whether they're going for a numbers game, I'll take anyone aged between 13 and 19 because they're likely to click on this and download this, and actually once they're in, you know, a few years later, their identity might be of value. In fact, actually, we're finding that younger people's identities are hugely valuable because they before they've started registering to vote or anything.
I think at this stage, that's fantastic. You've given an opening for the public to engage with you, and we'll certainly bring it back and ask you all to wrap up. But I think Phil...